this bolt of lightning shot across the universe and inspired me with the idea that we have to do a podcast. And that's what I wanted to tell you. We should do a podcast. Okay, bye.
There we go. I hit record too. It's recording on both of us now.
All right. Let's go. Welcome to Feature Creep, colon.
Built-in microwave, semicolon.
What did we decide on the topic?
Well, the other day you sent me a crazy story about crabs that
yes, that's right.
is a nightmare. And yes. also, I... These are all sort of food and parasite related discussions today. Yep. I also sent you the title, I think, of this podcast, the working podcast, semicolon, Fish or Chick, the Vagaries of Dinner Time Decision Making.
Fish or Chick?
Yeah. Fish or Chick. And I say chick because it's not chicken, because I generally don't eat chicken
because it
is a bird.
Right.
And I eat fake chicken. Which I just shortened to chick. Although I do eat fish sandwiches. It's kind of a weakness of mine. So, and also we talked about crazy soy sauce. And
yeah,
we do at some point have to talk about the recent moon circumnavigation voyage. But neither of us is an expert on the details of that to the extent that it would make even a partially interesting podcast. And so we need Damon to help us with that. And he's not here because he's solving all of the world's problems right now outside of the house. And good luck to him with that.
Good luck. Yeah.
So, yeah, you sent me this fucking crazy story about the crab, and we can talk about that first, or we can talk about my dinner dilemma, because I think this may be a universal human experience, and I'm curious about why this has become such a chore in my life. I love eating, right? Like eating is one of my favorite things to do. It's a great way to like get to know people through their food and like experience lots of stuff. And I could deal with never going on another vacation again if that's what had to happen, because in my neighborhood we have so many different types of food from so many different places in the globe, because as people may be aware of lately, we are a very multicultural city, which apparently pisses some people off a whole lot. But let me tell you that living embedded in that city with all of these options is actually what constitutes the richness of the human experience, and it's so great.
Right.
So woe unto anyone who's pissed off about variety. Anyway, we have all these great options. And so I love eating. You put something in front of me, I will eat it because I am an opportunivore. When presented with an opportunity to eat food, I will almost always take it. Although when I am in charge of my own decision making, I usually opt for something vegetarian, right? That's just how I roll. So like every night we go for a walk in our neighborhood with our neighbor and his dog and a different neighbor of ours. So now we are a gang of four and one quadruped.
And one quadruped.
And one quadruped. And after we get back from the walk, which is a mile long, we measured it out. We're always like, oh, good. Well, I worked up my evening appetite. Oh, fuck. What are we going to have for dinner? And it becomes this like monumental decision-making task where we're like, oh god, what's it gonna be? And usually the like decision fatigue comes from figuring out how to make food for ourselves, because buying food is easy but it's really expensive. And well, so we're like,
here's what I think we should do. We should do the front matter. Welcome to our podcast. I'm Ned.
Okay,
this is Meg.
Hi.
We are the same size. Our voices sound exactly the same. So it will be confusing, but you'll figure it out.
Like we're talking to ourselves.
Yeah. I think we should do food first, crabs second. The crabs one is really fucking creepy and weird. I mean, depends on how you... I mean, you'd probably be fascinated. But anyway, so I say we do your food topic first, and then we'll... Whatever time we have left, we'll segue into the crabs. Or... it'll be the worst podcast ever because they'll like get to the end and they'll be like, motherfucker, they're putting this on a different podcast. But you'll know because you'll see the title and you'll be like, oh, yeah, like Ned and Meg never get to the point.
Right.
You know, maybe that's
which is the point.
Which is the point. Yeah. So, yeah. Not to tease it too long, I'll just say that in terms of the crabs, we're talking about the I think it's Sakulina carcini. It's a kind of parasite, but we'll talk about that later. First, let's talk about the chick or fish. What is it? Chick or fish?
Chick or fish or fish or chick?
Fish or chick. Yeah.
The vagaries of dinnertime decision making.
Yes. Right. So.
And I chose the word vagaries because our process of selecting a dinner item on any given day is a meandering, long process of being an intellectual and culinary vagabond trying to cobble together some semblance of a whole meal, which sometimes we fail at, and I'm like, I'm just gonna have a bowl of cereal, is a cop-out, but also I love cereal and I always have like fresh fruit at my house, so I'm like, I'll just put some fruit on cereal, that'll do the trick. It's not the worst possibility. But yeah, like, why is it so fucking hard? I think this must be a cultural thing.
Yeah.
Because, like, as someone who likes almost all foods, no matter what they are, and will eat just about anything at any given time, this should not be hard.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm also able to express my opinions fairly succinctly. So, like, I know what I like and I don't like.
Right.
And so, like, picking something that I like on any given day should just be a matter of, like, pulling a piece of folded paper out of a hat and going for it. And yet, I struggle every day. And by the end of the day, I've had to make so many decisions usually that I'm like, I just don't want to make another fucking decision. I don't even really care. And I wonder if that's like fatigue is a major factor.
I feel like that's a big part of it. I feel like we're constantly fed decisions and things are vying for our attention in a way that is like overwhelming on the regular.
Yeah, they always are marketed as like life and death too, and they're like, God, the whichever thing I decide actually is really inconsequential in the grand scheme of things, and yet I'm putting a lot of emotional and intellectual energy into making this decision, and it just seems like a energy suck.
Yeah, no, it's totally an energy suck. I feel it constantly. I'm like, man, this is. Some days I dread like looking at my phone or, you know, logging into my computer. I'm just like, it's just an onslaught of fucking shit I have to decide about. And they're all meaningless.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
Totally inconsequential.
It's like,
One of the things that I have learned to do is when I triage so I hate my smartphone, but I did install the Graphene OS on it, which has made my life so much easier.
Yeah.
I had a Google phone. So I have an app on my phone that allows me to get all of the emails in my inbox through the app and kind of like sandbox it. And when I want to read an email in depth, I will do it on my laptop because the screen is so much bigger and I'm not like giving myself hand cramps using my thumbs. But if I want to triage my inbox and quickly root out anything that I don't feel like reading or don't feel like I have the time for.
Yeah.
I do that on my smartphone because the process is just like click, 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 shoop.
Right.
Click, 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 shoop. And I'm not inclined to pause on the things that I want to keep and read them at the time because reading on that tiny screen is so painful.
Yeah.
So I'm like, oh, that's like an easy way for me to wind down the number of decisions or the depth and breadth of those decisions that I have to make, because my inbox is kind of like the source of a lot of my fatigue, which is crazy because I'm in charge of what makes it through.
Right.
And I could just decide not to let certain things through and cut down on the total number of decisions I would have to make. I don't know. That's just one of these things. I think what I'm getting at here, like my working thesis here, is that like the things that we encounter as consumers in a consumer-driven culture in America are the very things that make us have decision fatigue And the way that they are marketed to us makes them seem like life or death decisions. So the emotional toll is very high for a very low payoff.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Something like that. Right. And right. I think this trickles down into end cases like me not being able to make a simple decision about what to eat for dinner.
Right.
And it's, I think that's a direct result of like the cultural forces at work in my life that I can't seem to get away from because there is no away.
Right. Right. Yeah. I think it's also like probably a lot of people can relate to the problem of like making dinner decisions. Like there are all kinds of skits around couples having problems deciding what's for dinner. Right. And so it's definitely like a classic conundrum. It's also, I imagine there's probably people who've studied this, like psychologists or somebody who's like had some philosophers maybe who've decided that they're going to study the human condition in a way that's like, let's look at how people decide what's for dinner. What's the context? Yeah. Where do they live? Who are they? Where do they culturally come from? Like how prevalent is this? And I, you know, earlier before we started this podcast, we were talking about frameworks, right? Like that idea of like people's mental frameworks not having certain things. And so they're just not even really aware of, like, you could imagine certain cultures where people are like, what do you mean deciding what's for dinner? So-and-so decides, right. Like that's how it works. Like, or, you know, it's like, there's a convention, right? That it's like, no, it's Tuesday. We have fucking beans and rice. Like that. What do you mean? What's for dinner?
Yeah. So maybe the fact that we have so many possibilities is itself a component of a structural component of the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it's, you know, the reality is it's like, you know, what do you mean? What's for dinner? Like the right amount of calories and nutrients that you need in order to survive for today. Like, I mean, it doesn't, right. You know, also maybe you'd like to have a little joy in your life. So you're having fucking tacos.
Right. Right. You know? Like this morning I told Damon, like, we went to the Ideal Diner this morning for breakfast, okay. As we do on Fridays. Yes. It is our thing.
Yeah.
But when we're not at Ideal Diner for breakfast, I make the same breakfast every day, my world's greatest breakfast sandwich, which took me some time to develop and is fantastic. And I will expound on that briefly because I'm proud of it. It's a brioche bun that is grill fried. Uh-huh. And then on the top side of the bun, you put a smear of avocados that have minced shallots and habanero peppers and salt and pepper in it. And then you use that glue to paste your greens to it. In my case, I use lacinato kale. In Damon's case, he likes peppery arugula. And then on the bottom bun, you put the cheese and then impossible sausage, spicy variety, and then an egg in some format. I prefer sunny side up. Damon likes his scrambled and shaped into like a little puck that goes into the sandwich.
Yeah.
And we have that every motherfucking day. I also put saffron on mine and I've started putting it on Damon's. And to this end, the reason that I did this was out of necessity because I was concerned that Damon wasn't getting adequate nutrition from his diet.
Yes.
And I was like, well, if we can stuff like really nutrient dense foods into the first meal of the day and make it really delicious, then we'll have no problem eating the same thing every day, which we don't. And I pointed out to Damon, we never have decision fatigue at breakfast and we eat the same fucking thing every day and we never get sick of it. And I just recently went to the eye doctor, and sometimes you don't know whether what you're doing is having an effect or not unless you like get a bunch of lab work done, which costs a bunch of money, and you can't go through a doctor to do it because you can't go to a doctor and be like, can you just do like a full exhaustive blood panel so I can see like where all my nutrient capacity is in my body? And they'll be like, I don't know, there's not like an insurance billing code for that because it's not a disease.
Right,
so like
right.
It's not a diagnosis, so like your insurance is going to pay for it, so no. And like I did find a lab here that we can go to, by the way, which is amazing. Anyway, so you never know, like you don't have the empirical evidence, the like data to show whether or not what you're doing to make yourself healthy is actually having any positive effect. So the other day I went to the eye doctor, got my contacts lens prescription renewed, and they did all of the tests and things and stuff to your eyes, and they test your the content in your blood of circulating carotenoids, help you maintain retinal health and prevent macular degeneration and all this other stuff, right? They tested mine, and my score was 717, which is more than double most average people's, and literally the highest score they've ever seen in a human being at this particular eye doctor.
Yeah.
We were all talking about it when I got there. They're like, what are you doing? And I was like, well, for one thing, I like cheat by taking AREDS pills, which are like astaxanthin and zeaxanthin and lutein and like fatty acids and omega-3s and all this stuff like stuffed into a little liquid pill. And I am no doubt that is having a positive effect, because the last time I went to the doctor, my score was in like the 500s, which was still really high compared to other people, almost still double.
Right.
But when I went in this time, it was crazy high because I've been eating that lacinato kale and eating saffron on my sandwich every fucking day for a year since. And like now my numbers are off the chart because I'm basically accomplishing my task that I set for myself, which was to ensure that if I only ate one thing a day, that it could be the first thing I ate and that all of my nutrient needs were taken care of with that single meal. And like now I know it's working on several levels.
Right.
And so like there's tons of fiber in that kale and shit too. So it's just like really good for me. And Damon doesn't hate the kale, and so I think I might switch him over. Because, like, have you noticed that arugula is, like, fine when you take it home from the store, and then overnight it's like, I'm dead in a slop fest in your fridge.
Does that... I don't have that experience.
Wow. Maybe, like, maybe I'll have to fuck around with the settings in
Yeah,
because
I
like,
usually...
Maybe it's too humid or not humid enough.
I used to get... when I lived near Trader Joe's, I used to just get the wild arugula bag. And
yeah.
It would just, I mean, you know, like it'd last a week, probably.
Right? Like, yeah. God, what is happening in my fridge? Other food doesn't spoil super fast. It's just the arugula. I cannot keep it fresh. So much so that I am now attempting to figure out how to grow arugula like year round in a rotational basis so that I don't have to keep buying it and I can just snip it when I need it and put it on a sandwich.
Yeah.
But anyway, like, yeah. So we... never get bored of those sandwiches. They're fucking delicious. I wake up hungry for them every day. And I'm like, why can't I have something like this with dinner? What's the difference? Like, what accounts for
right.
how difficult this is at the end of the day to just select something that's not going to kill me
yeah.
that I enjoy eating and like make that happen. And I keep stuff in my fridge that I like.
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm an aspirational shopper where I'm like, gotta eat a bunch of stuff I don't like because it's
right,
good for me.
Right.
Like, no, I just buy stuff that we like. And so our fridge is full of things that we want to eat and enjoy eating. I don't know why it's so hard at the end of the day to assemble them and then have a meal show up out of it.
Like, right. Right. Yeah.
What is the conundrum here?
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I'm curious if this is something other people experience on a daily basis as well. Like,
yeah.
I mean, probably this is the whole animating principle behind things like Uber Eats and DoorDash.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. Someone quick, just bring me food.
I mean,
I can't even handle it.
I think that's a big part of it, right? Is it's like we end up in this state where it's like you're drained by the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, your job is to probably make a bunch of dumb decisions that don't really matter, but you know, that works out. I think about how people are like, oh, it's like designed that way. And it's like, I don't know that it's designed that way. I think it fell in that way and it's easy to reinforce because it's beneficial to certain people who have a lot of money.
Like, yeah, and then you can exploit it.
Yeah. Like, you know, it's not that it's designed that. It's not like they're like, oh, then we'll have them do these dumb, unimportant jobs. It's more just like, you know, they're building an engine, a money funnel. And then they're like, oh, we can put some people in there. And then also the side effect of the money funnel is that these same people are drained and can't make decisions. And then, oh, turns out very easy to market shit to because we can just tell them how to feel and then make them really fucking upset. And then they go buy some more hamburgers or whatever the fuck they do.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, I think that's totally right. I was telling somebody the other day about why Damon and I finally got married.
Yeah.
And it's not that we didn't want to be married, but we were like, ooh, this institution and it feels so weird. And like, I don't know. I don't really love the idea of it. And so we ended up over time, over the 10 years that we've been together as a couple, we implemented all of these like workarounds to like Like, for example, during COVID, since we were not legally married, we did not by default have visitation rights if one of us ended up in the hospital.
Right.
And so the city of Minneapolis allowed couples to file domestic partnerships within the city so that if you were hospitalized in Minneapolis, your domestic partner had the same rights as a married spouse would to come visit you in the hospital if you got COVID. And so there was this and that and the other thing. And we were talking to accountants and like financial planners and all this stuff. And it was like, oh, my God, at some point we just realized like the one stop solution to all of these problems of social relations that we're trying to solve is to just get fucking married.
Right.
Like that's the solution.
Right. You're
to
like
all of this yeah. stuff. And so instead of doing it piecemeal, and I was thinking about this and I feel like a lot of the time. With in other sort of circumstances that are not about marriage, the structures that provide the thing that you need get eroded, and then someone tries to sell them back to you,
right,
in a different format. And I was thinking about this with regard to nutrition, right? Like I have way less of a problem making sure that I'm getting adequate nutrition and understanding what that even means than I have a problem of deciding what to eat per se.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like the nutritional part of it is taken care of. The just what do I feel like eating right now is the problem. And that's where the decision fatigue comes in. And I think for a lot of people, figuring out how to get adequate nutrition is really difficult. And a huge part of that that I want to acknowledge is that industrial agriculture destroys the value of nutrients that are possible, that it's possible to derive from the activity of living soil. Like industrial ag kills the microbiota in the soil that interact with plants that give the nutrients to plants that you then eat and get as nutrition, right? And like, that's a huge problem. But that aside, like, we have created all these weird industrial foods that break everything down into its component parts, pick and choose the components that are going to go into the engineered food, and then the nutrients all have to be added back in one by one, which is like if all you're eating is prepackaged food, that's why you are struggling with nutrition. Because the solution, just like the solution to all of these piecemeal parts that Damon and I were trying to assemble into a whole was like just to get fucking married. The solution to these nutrition problems is just to eat like actual food that like grows somewhere in soil that's not robbed of all of its nutrient capacity. And like, I think like a huge component of decision fatigue around food with people comes from like, what is even healthy? What can I assemble to ensure that the component parts give me adequate nutrition? Now I'm taking multivitamins every day.
Right.
Because I'm concerned that my food isn't actually feeding me. And I think that's super insidious. Like, because if you're trying to like single-handedly be like, I need to make sure I have all my amino acids. I need to make sure I have my micronutrients. I need to make sure I have my minerals. I need to make sure I have my like vitamins, all this stuff. Like that's so many fucking things to like keep track of. Oh my God. But if you like eat some fucking kale, it's just already right in there.
Right.
You don't even have to like think about it. So like that has to be a component of like dinner time decision fatigue, right? Like what even is the healthy thing to eat?
Yeah.
Like I mean all of these engineered foods.
It's tricky. I think there's, you know, I imagine there's lots of people who are not thinking about it at that level and they're still having decision fatigue.
Yeah. Oh my God, for sure, right?
Yeah. I found this thread on Reddit, which anyone I'm sure could find. It's from about 4 months ago, and it's titled "How to Decide Dinner: Suffer from Decision Paralysis? Please Help." PLZ.
nice.
And they go on to ask, "How do you decide what's for dinner each night? We tried meal planning each week, but it seems when it comes time, we don't feel like eating what we planned." Also, note
that's my problem too. Oh yeah. My God, my problem too.
Yeah, they go on to say, do note that we do enjoy cooking and are fairly good at it. The challenge is the decision piece. Helpful tips, please. So I just kind of bring this up because it's like, yeah, like I think lots of people are struggling with this issue, apparently.
This is a relatable problem.
Yeah. I can't. I only ever run into what's for dinner problems when I'm actually not hungry, or I'm with someone else, and it's like we've somehow fallen into the trap of deciding that we must eat now, but actually neither of us are hungry.
Yes. So when you are hungry, do you automatically become hungry for a specific thing?
Sometimes. So for me, it's like I've lived alone now for quite a while. So my like home dinners are usually I'm just cooking for myself. And so those are typically I have a very different relationship with food that I don't know is necessarily healthy. And I've been trying to kind of mitigate that a bit. But typically, like, I go to the grocery store. Sometimes I try to make decisions that are like, you know, buy stuff that I'm going to have for the week. Like, try to have stuff available. But generally speaking, I'm just buying a selection of options that are going to live in my fridge. And then later I'm going to eat them. And typically my eating habits are... I'm just going to eat all of that. It's like when I come home from the grocery store, it's like there's all the food and I'm just going to eat through it at whatever pace I decide. And like sometimes it's I'm having more, you know, I'm having this pizza or I'm having this like soup that I, you know, planned or whatever. Like, and when that happens, like I might have those three meals in a day and it's like, man, I just burned through all that food. And now I've, you know, have to either go back to the grocery store or figure out like, then I'm, you know, digging into the pantry the next day. Right. I'm like, oh, here's some dried beans or whatever. So I don't necessarily struggle with decisions about what to eat. It's usually just like, the decision's always easy. It's like whatever the highest value meal is, right? Like,
yeah,
by value, I mean like what's the most calorie dense or what's the most, not necessarily calorie dense, but like what's going to be the most appealing, like sugar wise or flavor wise. Like, you know, I'm definitely going to choose that pizza over like a very bland, like kale soup or something, right? Like I'm going to eat the kale soup later, but right now I'm going to choose the pizza or I'm going to choose the, you know, whatever the thing is. So for me, it's like I typically don't struggle with that too much. But I also think that I usually try to think of like as I'm getting older and I'm trying to like really address that, I try to think of the fridge as like it's a restaurant menu. Like I stock it as such. Mm-hmm. There's a variety of meals that I can make from the menu at any given time. Typically for me, I think I usually have like maybe two or three solid go-to meals that are always like kind of stocked in the fridge. Like when I go to the grocery store, I'm like, well, I'll get more of that because like lately I've been on a kick of like making, I've been trying to get enough protein every day. So I've been eating a lot more like meat, like red meat in particular. And so I try to get, like there's a couple of different cuts that are pretty cheap. From the butcher for beef. Mm-hmm. And so I typically get like a shoulder cut, which is usually about $7.99 a pound here in San Diego.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Like it's pretty good. And I like it. And the way I cook it is I just slice it very thin and I kind of do like you would do with pho. Like I basically cook a stew, like I cook soup. So I'll cook like a broth. Like I'll make, I'll cut up ginger. So I can also, I live in a, heavily Mexican influenced neighborhood, and so all of the grocery stores have a huge amount of cilantro for very cheap. You can usually get like bushels of it for under a buck, like, you know, just a huge amount of it. And also like ginger, there's an Asian market where I can get a huge bag of ginger for a couple of bucks. It's just like huge amounts of it, right? So
good for you.
Yeah, so I get those things and I cut them up and I boil them in water, and then I have like a couple of different things. I sometimes put mushrooms in there or like some onions or whatever. I just kind of make like a sort of vegetarian broth. And then I either sometimes put like some of those, like, you know, those like mung bean noodles, those like glass noodles.
Yeah.
Sometimes I put those in there, and then I chop up a bunch of the cilantro, two cups of it. Right. And that goes in a bowl. Tons. And the whole thing is kind of like a pho preparation. So you like pour the broth over the thinly sliced beef and it cooks in the hot water, like right there.
Yep.
And so that's like one of my go-tos. I can cook it very quickly.
That's really good.
Yeah. I can cook it very quickly. Sometimes I do chicken where I boil the chicken. I don't eat chicken raw, but I like, we'll cut the chicken up. Like, I'll cut the chicken up and like cook it in the soup that way. So that's like kind of been my, like, I have a lot of like one pot soup like meals that I prepare lately. I used to have other things that I did. But my point is that I often have, like, I try to stock the freezer in a way that it's like, okay, those will keep a while. So those, you know, the things in the freezer, like, I buy those like once a month, and then they're kind of my fallback when I'm just like, nope, I don't want any of this. I'm gonna have something else. I like reading this particular post, I wonder if their problem is like, you know, of course you can't, you don't know what you're going to be in the mood for on the day. Have some fucking flexibility. Like, you know, have the five meals or whatever that you have for the week, but like, be open to the idea that you're like, I'm going to switch it up. It's also why I typically just have like, I try to just have like, these are my fresh ingredients that I'm going to have to consume this week. These are my frozen ingredients, which I have to consume like this month or this, you know, this quarter or whatever, like, you know, in the next like 10 weeks or whatever. You know, and then canned foods and dried goods that are like, oh, you know, if I just caught out, I know I can always make some rice and beans, or I can make something that's gonna. But I also live alone. So the decision process is different. I think that there's a certain kind of decision process that, like, there's a layer of problem when you have other people involved.
I think that it makes it exponentially more complicated.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because, like, I, so in my situation, I live with a person from Texas who would eat nothing but meat.
Right.
Literally. And eating meat is kind of the one thing that I don't do.
Right.
So there is, like, on our Venn diagram, there is very little overlap. And oftentimes, because I am the person who can be the most flexible in this situation, I end up accommodating the person who eats in a way that I would not choose to eat.
Yeah.
And so unless I'm willing to do the labor of making two separate types of meals to completion every dinner service or breakfast or lunch or whatever we're doing, I am stuck. I have to be dislocated from my comfort zone into the comfort zone of another person to accommodate their eating style, who I am also dependent on. And so I have a vested interest in making sure that they eat healthy enough to live for a while longer.
Right, right.
Which was sort of like the thrust behind the, like, I'm commandeering breakfast, I'll figure it out.
Yes.
You know, like, I need to make sure you don't die of diabetes.
Right.
It says the person who eats fucking breakfast cereal for dinner. You don't get diabetes. I'm going to be the one who gets it. Watch. So, like, speaking of which, we went out to dinner because occasionally I'll be like, I think I want to eat a cheeseburger. And we went to this place by our house called Stanley's that is like the best bar food you've ever eaten in your life. It's so good. There's something on the menu for everybody. I usually end up having this like gargantuan salad that they make with like pecans and grapes and cherries and all this other stuff on it. And it's fucking delicious. But if they also have like a bunch of different types of burgers that are incredible. And they have one that's made with like figs and blue cheese. That's just like, the flavor profile is amazing. I was like, I'm going to eat that burger. And then for like 5 days afterwards, I was in like gross, bent over intestinal pain because my body doesn't ever digest red meat, ever. And I ate like 6 ounces of it in a sitting in this giant ass burger, which I basically finished while we were sitting there. And oh my God, I was dying.
Yeah.
And I told Damon, the next time I think it's a good idea to have a burger, be like, no, you can't eat that. Because it's not like I shouldn't eat it. Right. It's not a like is or ought problem. It's like, no, you can't, because your body biologically can't handle digesting it. And like, I didn't poop for like 3 days, like 2.5 days or 3 days. I didn't poop. And when I did, like, hardly anything came out of me because I think that like it all just absorbed into my body or something. I don't know. It was not great. It was not ideal. I was regretting it emotionally, physically, psychologically for
I'm the sure
part of a week.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Oh God. But, you know, I eat a lot of green stuff that has a lot of protein in it too. Like, I think I get badgered a lot by people who are like, are you eating enough protein? And I'm like, Jesus God, it's literally in every, it is the structure of life. If you ate something that was alive at one point, like, there's, you're getting protein. It's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like, oh my God, I was just wrecked by that burger. It was like 35 minutes of joy while it was going in, and then like days of retribution afterwards. That mm-hmm. burger came back to punish me. Holy shit. What a trial that was. Yeah, so I guess like I think maybe not to throw my spouse under the bus while he's not here to defend himself, but I think part of my decision fatigue comes from the fact that I'm like, I would just go in the fridge, assemble a bunch of ingredients into something
and
either heat it up or not, and then just eat it.
Right.
And it would be fine because I only buy things that I like.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the problem here is one of overlap. There is not a lot of overlap. And so figuring out what to make that will also satisfy the other person in the house becomes part of the problem, I guess, if you want to call it a problem of decision making. Yeah, interesting. What else do people say in that Reddit thread? Do you still have it open? What were people's suggestions for mitigating the difficulty?
Let's see. So there's some suggestions to make a weekly meal plan, but only loosely decide on which day they'll eat the meal, any particular meal. That's kind of what I suggested. I'm like, you know, you just kind of just have a menu option. Then someone else said they always do a 3x meat-based and 2x vegetarian meal for the weekdays, and always some kind of pasta with a nice bottle of wine on Sunday. This is just people saying, this is how I eat. They're not really talking about how they make the decisions. Let's see.
I'm interested in like a decision tree process, like a structure for making these decisions when you're like, I don't know. Just follow the process. Lay down the dots, follow the dots, right?
Yeah. I mean, this is more like somebody's like, just buy stuff that's on sale, watch some chef videos for inspirations, make some shit. I mean, that's kind of like, you know, but it does. I think you kind of pointed out something that if you or someone you know that you're trying to make this decision mm-hmm. with are a very particular or picky eater, mm-hmm. then this does become a problem because you're more like it's hard to I know some picky eaters, and sometimes it's hard because it's like they don't really think of themselves as picky eaters, and they're just gonna be like, no, I'm cool with whatever. And you're like, how about this? Well, I mean, not that.
No.
Right. I mean, not sushi. Like, you know, okay, well, how about some ramen? Well, no, I mean, like, you know, and then eventually you find out it's like, so Kraft macaroni and cheese, got it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's very, you know, and if you're a parent, I imagine this is like a nightmare, right? Because you're just like, well, I had this plan and I don't get to fucking follow it because I can't get my kids to eat any food. And at some point you're as a parent, you're like, I need to, they just need fucking calories. They're kids.
Right.
They just need some fucking calories. Give them a fucking scoop of ice cream and fucking send them on their way. Like, you know what I mean? Like, no, it's not fucking winning any parenting awards that night, but you know, you did get some calories in your kid, and tomorrow they're gonna burn them off like twice as fast. So you know, it's kind of like, you know, have a little you know, forgiveness for yourself if that's the situation you find yourself in. That's my opinion.
Like, we're also like really separated from the, like, this is gonna sound totally Marxist, we're separated from the means of production of food.
Yes.
So, like, we're not in relationship with our food. We don't, like, select it and grow it and foster it and have a slow relationship with that food that allows for a lot of room to, like, experiment and get to know what it's good, what it tastes good in, and how to prepare it and stuff. And so all of a sudden you just get all of this stuff and you're like, what do I do with any of this?
Right.
Like, I don't know how to.
Yeah.
It's unreasonable to expect people to know how to make food for themselves if they've never been taught how to do that. You don't know how to do anything until someone teaches you, or until you undertake and have the skills to undertake learning it on your own, which who fucking has time for that right now? People are exhausted on purpose.
Yeah.
Because it makes them susceptible to marketing.
Speaking of Marxism.
Yeah, right. Right. I'm a food Marxist.
I was recently on vacation driving around on an old 4x4 trail. And
yeah.
And I keep having this daydream about that. I don't know if it's like a webcomic or like a what do you call it? Like a graphic novel? I don't know. But
yep.
Carla Marx, right? So Carla Marx is a sort of like feminist Marxist who drives around in the backcountry in a 4x4. And I've just got the setup. It's like she basically like applies Marxism to like obscure, like, you know, 4x4 bros driving around on the trails, right? Yeah. And it's not even like I'm like, oh, it's going to be about like, you know, identifying and like making fun of like people who do that. It does. There are lots of kinds of people who like overlanding and spending time in the country or in the, you know, in the fucking nature and the outdoors for lots of reasons. So it's not like some kind of like, well, I'm going to pick on the fucking gun toting assholes or whatever and have this like feminist Marxist hero woman like come in. It's more just like, I just think it's a funny setup where it's like she could go interact with these, with not just those people, but like any people that are out on the trail and set up these like scenarios where it's just some, you know, every comic or whatever, like whatever couple of panels are like a, you know, some Marxist quote twisted into some kind of like, I don't know. I've been trying to kind of envision what it looks like and like what it would take. Like I have this picture in my mind that it's this kind of Calvin and Hobbes style like art,
totally.
Right? Like very very like meaningful enough that you fully understand like what's going on, but not so deep that it's like, oh man, like every fucking page is a fucking, you know, detailed painting or whatever. Just kind of, I don't know. Anyway, should we talk about the parasite? Should we get into the gross portion?
Oh my god, it's so creepy and insane. Oh god. Yes, let's talk about it because we can't sit alone with this. We have to tell other people.
Share with the world. So I'm gonna start with the Wikipedia entry to kind of give us context. So crabs live in the ocean typically. And there is a parasite called the I think it's Sacculina carcini.
Sounds right.
Yeah, or the crab hacker barnacle. And it's a species of parasitic barnacle in the family Sacculinidae. In particular, a parasitic castrator of crabs, So the crab most often is used as a host is the green crab, the natural range of which is the coast of Europe and North Africa.
Atlantic crabs.
Yeah. It can be found attached to the crab's abdomen and affects consumption rates by humans. So there's the entire Sacculinidae family, which is this crab hacker barnacle family, known for their ability to induce parasitic sterilization in crabs. Thompson in 1836 established that the species, or discovered them, I guess, and it was the first and most studied barnacle parasite.
Are these like the same barnacles that attach to ships, or like a different type of barnacle?
Different type of barnacle entirely.
Like
similar in concept.
But totally different in function, obviously.
Yeah. So I'll
like the yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I'll read the appearance. So the individuals differ greatly between males and females. The female barnacles look like small slugs between entering the crab and infecting it. So in their life cycle, before they enter the crab and infect it, they look like these small little slugs. Once they have infected their host, they begin to develop and grow tendrils. This allows them to get the nutrients that it needs from their host. So basically, they kind of go under the shell of the crab and live inside of its body, effectively. And so they grow out these tendrils that, like a nervous system, right, that spreads out into
and don't they follow the crab's nervous system also?
Yes, yeah.
And
so this allows them to get nutrients from their host. Over time, it can be seen hanging off the crab's abdomen filled with reproductive tissue. So, so the crabs, if you're not familiar with crabs, they are a kind of six-legged or eight-limbed kind of ocean crustacean. Typically, they have two pincers and then they've got six legs. Three on each side. Right down at the butt underneath is where they typically have their gonads. There's kind of this flap. And so that whole flap area gets filled with and replaced by the sort of reproductive part of the barnacle.
The barnacle.
Yeah. And it's
so they sterilize the crab.
Yeah,
so they eat up the crab. Doesn't have its own reproductive parts.
Yeah, they consume the crab gonads. Yeah.
They replace that with their own reproductive shit that hangs out of the crab and is visible to the naked eye.
Yeah. And so the male parasites are much smaller, and their only purpose is to help the female reproduce. So they kind of they find an established female, and then basically, like, once the male barnacle guy, whatever, is sort of floating through the water, and then probably follows some kind of like scent or whatever, and finds an active female barnacle who is fully parasitized and colonized a crab body, and then
and meanwhile the crab just goes about life normally, doing what a crab would normally do, with the exception of mating.
Yeah, so they can't mate, and they can't and they can no longer what's it called where they shed their shell,
molt.
They can no longer molt. So here's the life cycle. So the female larva settles on a suitable crab host and crawls across its surface until it finds a suitable spot, such as the base of some bristles, like they call it the seta. It then develops into a form called a kentrogon, which inserts a stylet into the crab and pushes its way inside. So basically, like a virus, like if you can imagine those viruses that like inject their DNA into a cell. From there, it moves through the inside of the crab, in due course pushing out a sac known as the externa on the underside of the crab's abdomen. The part remaining inside, the interna, great naming here, guys.
Super creative.
Yeah, but also good job. Why call something what it isn't? So
it is what it says it does.
Yeah,
it does what it is.
Yeah,
whatever.
Right, thing what does what it says.
Yeah.
So the interna develops tendrils which spread throughout the crab. They take over the stomach, intestines, and nervous system to absorb nutrients and enable the parasite to control the behavior of the host. That's the crazy part. It's not that like now you have this parasite. It's like now you do what the parasite bids. Like your body now moves the way the parasite wants it to move. So
it's like remote control.
Yeah, it's fucking crazy.
But not, because it's not remote, it's embedded. It's like, oh god.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so gross and weird.
So the presence of the parasite inhabits the development of the crab's gonads, which eventually The presence of the parasite inhibits the development of the crab's gonads, which eventually atrophy. It also prevents the crab from molting, consequently preventing it from regenerating lost limbs. The parasite causes a male crab to develop certain feminine characteristics, including the broadening of its abdomen. While in females, the abdomen becomes narrower and the pleopods degenerate. What are pleopods? I feel like we need to know what a pleopod is.
Yes. Vocabulary time.
The anatomy of a decapod consists of 20 body segments grouped into two main body parts, the cephalothorax and the pleon abdomen. So each segment, often called a somite, may possess. So that's. Oh, the pleopods are the segments.
Okay.
Oh, no. The pleopods, I'm sorry. The pleopods are these sort of swimming legs. So if you've seen, they're like,
yes,
they're almost like little cilia or like they're not the legs. Like,
yeah, they're like little finny guys.
Yeah, they're like, yeah, and there might be many of them that like that wave in the water, right, to move it through the water.
Yeah.
So that's what a pleopod is. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah. So in females, the abdomen becomes narrower, and the pleopods degenerate. The eggs of the parasite develop in the externa, and both male and female crabs carry these eggs around, secured under their abdomen. In the way that female crabs normally care for their own brood, but males never do.
Oh, right.
Yeah. If the parasite is experimentally removed from the host, female crabs will usually regenerate their ovaries, but in males, sex change takes place and they develop ovarian tissue. Interesting. So what I think the understanding from that is that if a male crab is infected with a parasite, one of these parasites, then effectively they internally have like a sex change, and and even if you remove the parasite after that, the crab remains female.
Right.
The eggs inside the externa are fertilized by male larvae, which enter the sac through a pore. These males are tiny, never become adults, and soon die. However, the female, including the externa, can live for as long as the crab host survives, perhaps 1 or 2 years. Hundreds of eggs are produced every day and remain in the sac for about 6 weeks. When the parasite eggs are ready for release, the crab will climb onto a rock, bob about to release them, and wait and waft them on their way, like in the water. The cycle then continues with each generation. So that's the gist of it, and why we were both just like, ugh, damn.
Yeah.
That's
it's a gnarly horror show.
Yeah.
Like, it's so creepy to me that they basically become a chimera. Like, the where the parasite ends and the crab begins gets less and less clear the more developed the parasite is, because it infiltrates and becomes a component of the crab's nervous system to such an extent that they become inseparable and are sort of like no longer a crab and a parasite, but like a new thing.
Yep.
In and of itself. Why is the idea of a parasite so disturbing?
It's body horror, right? Like, it's
yeah,
it's you know, it's the idea of like the ultimate invasion of your person. It's the loss of autonomy, but also not the loss of your life. So it's like it's like a real torture, you know? Like, it's not just that it's painful. It's like, I mean, I think it's
a
why
slow
there's
slow
yeah, it's
existential demise.
Yeah. Like, it's very much I think there's lots of like horror films that explore this, right? And it makes us uncomfortable.
Yeah. Man, like I, aside from the fact that things like ticks, which are parasites, can give you diseases, which is like in and of itself a problem that's bad and to be avoided, right?
Right.
Just the idea of a tick, like, ooh, why are they so creepy? Why do they look like that? Why do they suck your blood? Like, I don't know. It's gross. Or like worms, like parasite worms are really gross and creepy. I knew someone who had a tapeworm.
Really?
Yeah. She did like, was she in the Peace Corps? She went to like lots of places to help communities that had insufficient sanitation and things like that.
Yeah.
And would like work on projects to put in infrastructure to improve people's health outcomes and things like that. And she picked up a tapeworm somehow and like came back to the United States after she was done working and like had to take medication to get rid of the tapeworm. And when she pooped it out, it was like 6 feet long.
Yeah, that's crazy. I do know they get really big. Yeah. Ooh.
And she lost a ton of weight.
Sure.
Because it ate all of her food. Yep, like she was like starving because she couldn't absorb any of the nutrients before the worm ate it. Which is just like,
right.
Oh my God. I can't imagine that. I can't imagine pooping out a tapeworm.
No,
ooh, I don't know. Think about it.
I know. It's so, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, having parasites are, like those bot flies that like lay eggs under your skin.
Yeah.
And then yeah. Like it's, you know.
Oh my God, so freaky.
Yeah. It's vulnerability, right? Like you feel deeply vulnerable because it's like this enemy is within. Like the call came from inside the house. Like, you
know, right, like, right. Yes.
Get out of there. God, I can't. It is me.
Yeah. It is me.
Yeah.
Oh. That makes me think of like in zombie movies when people are like, I don't want to kill them. And they're like, they're not them anymore. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I told Damon, if you ever are possessed or become a zombie, I will totally take your head right off.
Just take it right off. Right away.
I'm not even going to hesitate. I just want you to know that.
Uh-huh.
Please do the same to me. Don't hesitate.
Right.
God. I wonder what kind of like super creepy and weird things are going to crop up when all of the like permafrost melts.
Yeah.
Like what kind of horrific body horror are we going to be subjected to in the future,
right,
when things from the like distant Lovecraftian past rise again and like
right
take like, over a population that has no defenses against it.
I think there's a lot of speculative fiction around that whole idea of like, you know, like something, some ancient virus or whatever that used to exist and like now we have no resistance to it, but because there was like, you know, it was buried in a mountain of ice or whatever, it never really mattered until all of a sudden somebody goes mining for oil or some stupid shit.
Right.
I, even though I studied biochemistry in college, I just don't know I don't know how really viable that is. Like, I think there are a lot of already pretty terrible viruses that we've worked pretty hard to like eradicate and like treat.
Yes.
And the fact that we like now live in a country and really a world where people are like questioning whether that was a good idea. What? Are you nuts?
What?
Yeah, it was a very good idea. Like so many people, so much suffering was alleviated because of that.
Yeah, like, oh my God, aren't people getting polio again?
Yeah, no, it's fucked. The measles, the fucking measles are fucking roaring in the U.S. now. What the fuck?
Did I tell you I got a blood titer for measles immunity?
No, really?
Yeah, because Damon and I were both born, and you too.
Oh, yes.
All three of us were born in an era
where
we received a version of the measles vaccine that was supposed to confer permanent immunity against measles infection. But for some people in our cohort, the immunity wore off.
Right.
And so you have to get revaccinated. And the only way to tell is to have a blood test to see whether you still have the antibodies in the titer.
Oh, right.
And so the last time I was at the doctor, I was like, hey, while you're doing my blood test for like lipids and shit, can you also toss on a titer for measles immunity to make sure that I still have immunity to measles, since that's like a thing we have to worry about again now because everything's great. And they came back and they were like, yes, you definitely have immunity. I was like, thank God.
Right.
I do not want to die of measles in the year 2026.
I'm looking at the CDC website, which tragically is probably not as viable a source as we would like it to be these days.
Yes.
No fault of the people probably working very hard to still publish. Like, so there's a measles cases and outbreak page that's, you know, updated as of today. And as of yesterday, there were 1,748 confirmed measles cases reported in the United States in 2026.
Oof. The last time I looked, it was in the 600s.
Yeah. No, it's not good. And I, it just blows my mind how we have somebody who is like, yeah, let's not vaccinate people anymore, in charge of this shit.
Yeah.
The fact that anyone could take that guy seriously is just fucking nuts. Measles is bad. Like, it's not good.
Oh, yeah.
It will.
It's like.
Yeah. Like.
When I think about, like, what, you know, when we figured out wide scale manufacturing of vaccines,
yeah,
like, there was a prioritization process that occurred to decide what to tackle first. And like,
yeah,
polio and measles were right up there.
Yep.
So, you know, they're not fucking great.
Right. I like, 1 in 1,000 people get encephalitis from measles, which is, if you don't know what that is, it's a swelling of the brain, which, you know.
Right.
I,
that's like, what happened to me with the shingles.
Yeah. It's.
Yeah. It's, I cannot recommend that, friends.
It can.
Do not get encephalitis.
Cause lasting brain damage.
Yep.
It's not good. Yeah. Pneumonia. Yeah. Like, it's. It also fucks up your immune system. So
mm-hmm.
it makes you more susceptible to other germs and infections.
Mm-hmm. Is it, does it cause like changes in your genetics too? Does it say anything about that?
I don't see that here, but I would not necessarily be surprised. I mean, I think a lot of things we're learning do that.
Measles is a virus, right? Is it a virus or a bacteria?
I'm assuming it's a virus. Let's see what the, where's my, there we go. You guys couldn't say right at the top that it's a virus or a, so I'm looking at the Wikipedia article and yeah, virus.
Okay. Yeah. A ton of viruses give you cancer after the fact because they do really weird things to your DNA after they infect you. And then your DNA becomes faulty over time and malfunctions. And then that's when you end up with weird forms of cancer. Like Epstein-Barr virus.
Yeah.
Leads to like weird, like nose and throat cancer. I think shingles leads to other weird forms of cancer and dementia. That's another thing. Like, it's fucking crazy. I had a thought and then it just like totally escaped me. Fuck, what was it? I don't remember. But yeah, viruses are super weird.
Yep.
Which we've talked about before because we did a whole thing about coronavirus and like that was in the early stages of shutdown and everything we said turned out to be like dead accurate.
Yep.
Yeah. So here's an interesting thing about my weird body. I have like hyper flexible joints, hyper mobile joints. So my things come out of socket a lot. Like my shoulders just pop out of socket and my ribs and like my elbows and like my feet, all of the joints in my feet get weird.
Yeah.
And it's fucking painful. But you know, whatever. Anyway, the person who is helping me, one of the people helping me deal with this ongoing and never ending problem.
Yeah.
Is like, have you ever been tested for like autoimmune diseases of any kind? And I was like, no, but it's interesting that you say that because when I got shingles, it was a central nervous system issue, not like a dermatological issue. And my body responded by giving me a cytokine storm, which is why like shit went crazy and I ended up with all kinds of lasting damage. And then because it wasn't treated, because nobody figured out what it was, I ended up with viral encephalitis from it. And then I got brain damage in addition to central nervous system damage outside of my brain.
You're welcome.
Yes, you're welcome. But, you know, now I have these awesome bragging rights. So totally worth it. Yeah. So now I'm like, maybe I should go get tested for autoimmune stuff because that might explain a lot of things in retrospect.
Yeah. I mean, You know, if you
be
can,
interesting.
Yeah.
Damon got his DNA sequenced and we're waiting for the results of that.
Oh, shit.
Mm-hmm. I might do mine, too.
It's a big number. There's a lot of genes in our bodies.
There are a lot of genes. I love how, like, now scientists have kind of, like, reluctantly come around to accepting the fact that, like, there is no such thing as junk DNA.
Yeah.
And the fact that they ever called it that was just because they were real fucking lazy.
Yeah.
Not yep. junk.
No, not junk.
Biology doesn't really have junk.
Yeah, it's kind of... I feel like one of the big revelations, at least while we were like while I was studying biochemistry, was that was like kind of coming around was the idea that your genes can be turned on and off, and so external factors can influence what proteins are being produced in your body.
Yes.
And that has some like real ramifications. You know, it's like, oh, you would be a different person if you grew up in a different place, even if you had the same starting conditions. Like, you know.
So after I turn in this thesis that I'm working on and I am done with official school of every kind forever for the rest of my life forever because I'm not doing this anymore. And here's why. Because, and I am vindicated in this regard, Wikipedia, the crowdsourced internet encyclopedia,
yes,
has established the fact that they will not allow AI to generate or edit the articles on their website, which means, and this is absolutely true, that Wikipedia now has higher, more rigorous standards for the creation and dissemination of shared knowledge than every fucking university and college in our country.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I am done with higher ed. I am so, so disappointed. The credibility that higher ed used to have with me has been completely vacated.
I also really appreciate that, like, at least when I was in my undergrad, like, Wikipedia was like already in full swing, but there were, it really went back and forth. By the time from the start of college, when people are like, you can't cite Wikipedia, it's not a valid source, to the end of college where I was being taught in classes that Wikipedia is often well researched and a good place to start from, and often a great platform to start your research from and understand and find good sources and you know, and we were now learning about media literacy instead of like being like, oh, here's how you evaluate the article. Here are the problems that they have. Like, you know, one of the problems they have is like that self-referential issue where it's like someone writes a Wikipedia article and says, oh, there's no citation for this. So then somebody goes and makes a website and then cites the website, right? Like it's kind of you know, and I think people forget that there's different problems with that. Like some things it's like that doesn't matter because maybe the website is correct. Maybe it's something more fundamental that we're all like, you know, it's like some physical fact, right? It's like, no, this is how physics works, our best understanding of it. The fact that it wasn't cited and then now it was cited because somebody put up a website explaining their understanding of it, that's still, that's more in the scientific realm of like, from my point of view, sort of the scientific method, right? Like it's that whole idea of like, verify. No, you do verify.
Right.
Like, am I able to reproduce this? No. Okay, why not? Let's talk about that. And then eventually you're like, nope, it looks like, you know, we were wrong. That's not how it works. Or we were right because, you know, we're as right as 10,000 people who've been able to replicate the experimental outcome. Like, we're still happy to change our minds tomorrow, but for today, we're going to lean on that. But you know, and I don't know. It's... Some of the like social sciences, I think, struggle more, right? Because you're dealing with historical fact that is like we're watching it happen. We're currently living in a time where there is a very small group of people who are radically attempting to change history in the US, like actively. Like, nope, that's not what happened. This is what happened.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's fucking, you know, it's a tragedy.
Yeah, like the CDC website.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a version of that.
Yeah.
Retconning the CDC website.
I don't understand the... like, I guess it's, I also come from a place where it's like, I don't have any like fucking ties to my family. They're fucking garbage. Like, I don't, I'm not like, oh, my family, but my poppy, my grandpaps, like, you know, he fought in the war. Like, I think it's cool that he fought in the war. Like, I didn't do that. I think it's interesting that he was a World War II pilot. And I think that, you know, I can have some ideas and thoughts about who he was, and maybe he was a good person some of the time and maybe he wasn't. It doesn't matter to me. Like, it's not me. I didn't do that.
Right.
And so I don't understand why there's this huge grudge about the people who are just like, oh, you know, like Civil War, wow, like we lost or we didn't lose or whatever. Like, why are you erasing our, like, you know, our generals and shit? And it's like, why do you care? Like, none of us live in that world anymore anyway. We all just live in a world of dodge the fucking money funnels and hopefully you don't get chewed up by the fucking machine up there. Like, what? Right. Like, who fucking cares about, like, why that shit is, that ship sailed, man. Like, we're not fighting that war anymore. Now we're fighting the fucking rich. Like, you know, like, we're not, like, I don't know. It just feels very, like, what a luxury to live in a world where you're like, oh, but my legacy and, you know, my proud history and my culture. And I'm like, yeah, no, we live in a world where, like, people are trying to fucking survive. And you've got these assholes who are just, like, systematically destroying the world we tried to build together.
Yeah. The consensus reality.
Yeah. Like, they're just fucking tearing it apart. And some of these people, they don't give a fuck. They're like, yeah, end of times. I believe that, you know, God's coming and fucking, you know, what is it? Immanentize the eschaton, motherfuckers. Let's go.
Immanentize the eschaton.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Damon and I are fond of saying that tradition is peer pressure from dead people.
Yes, but yes.
That was only funny in a context where you could rely on that tradition to be static and endure chronologically through time, right?
Yep.
And now that that's all contested, it's like, oh man, I could really do with some fucking dead people tradition pressure right now.
Yeah, fuck.
Like, again, like, all of this too, this re-litigating the nature of reality on a daily basis, God, also contributes to fucking decision fatigue, right?
Yes,
of which, I can't have fucking dinner because I have to rehash whether something happened or not all the time.
Right, yes.
That's how I bring it around full circle. Look at that. We made it back to the start. Oh my God, we did it. Oh God, having to contest everything, just everything turning into a battle of wills at all time. Oh, this morning I helped out at the food shelf at the church that my neighbor is a pastor at. And these are some of the most organized people I've ever met.
Yeah.
This food shelf is immaculate. And they have this really cool process where people coming into the food shelf to receive food fill out a shopping form. And the form has standard things that are always available at the food shelf. So they check off what they want. They turn in the form. People whose role, so to speak, is that of shopper, who are familiar with how the inventory in the food shelf is organized, those shoppers go in and they shop for the food according to the wishes of the people who filled out the form, and then assemble that shopping list and then bring the groceries back to the people. Uh-huh. And then the form gets filed so that we can track, because, you know, regulatory stuff, you got to track. If you're an official food shelf, you got to track this stuff.
Yeah.
And so, like, the pantry itself stays in this, like, immaculate state of organization at all times. And how much of what's available is readily visible on the shelves. And then there's an overflow stock that restocks the shelves so that the pantry shelves are always full. And if there's something missing on the shelf, you know that you need to acquire more of it, because it wouldn't be empty if we didn't already have it. And so, it's so organized that volunteer shifts to help, like, unload incoming groceries and organize them on the shelves and everything, the shifts are only an hour long, because that's as long as it takes to get all of it done.
That's great.
At a food shelf that serves hundreds of people a week.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It's amazing. And I was like, I really appreciate, like, the organizational continuity in this food shelf. And one of the people I was working with today was like, yeah, I think everybody here is kind of like obsessed with like sorting. Like we're all people who derive joy from like sorting and organizing things. And I was like, yeah, I'm in the right place. Everything in my life is some version of just like running an algorithm in reality and like in three-dimensional space and like organizing things and having a process, which is probably where I'm like, where's the decision tree for dinner?
Right. Like, right.
Maybe, you know, I guess you need to be the change you want to see in the world. Maybe I should make a decision tree and then we should post that to Reddit and be like, all these other people are just talking about what they do. Here's a process that you can use.
Well, maybe we can workshop it. Like, look,
yeah,
the decision tree, right? Like you're going to have to, you know, let's start at the top level. Like, am I hungry? Yes or no? No, then you're done. No decision to be made. Like, do we have to, you know, I guess you could... I guess from there you could say, am I going to not have time to eat later?
Yes.
Right. Because now you're like in a totally different branch where you're like, this decision is, what kind of decision am I making? Do I know I'm hungry? Am I at home? Am I going to like, do I have time to prepare a meal? Do I have ingredients for it? Right. Like these kind of questions, like that's the top level shit. Or the question is like, if I'm not hungry, but I know I need to eat right now because I'm about to go do something that I'm not going to have time to eat later, I do need to eat a meal, then, you know, maybe the decision tree is that there's room for customization there, right? Because now you're like, okay, probably you want something that is going to have maybe like a low glycemic index because you need it to kind of, you're not hungry now, but you know later you're going to need some food to keep sustaining you or some energy. So you want like, you know, probably like a protein and some, you know, good greens or whatever. But
yes. Right.
You know, but you now you're categorizing shit into like, what kind of meal is it? Is it a quick meal? Is it something that I need to prepare quickly? Is it, you know, and now you're in the realm of like, once I have my decision tree, how do I stock my pantry such that I'm prepared to handle these decisions, right?
Mm-hmm. Ooh, this could be a really worthwhile endeavor.
Sure.
Yeah. That's food for thought. You know what I need? You know what I need is just a parasite that makes all these decisions for me.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean, maybe the parasite's fucking great.
Or you need a parasite.
Maybe the crabs are just fucking on ecstasy the whole fucking time once they're infected because they're just like their nervous system's overloaded and they just don't fucking care anymore.
You know what?
I mean,
find me a parasite.
Right. Yeah.
And I'll tell you, maybe we can just set up that lab in my basement and start biohacking parasites and then make ones for ourselves and we can figure out the right way, whether it's worth it or not.
Right. Become start the pod people or whatever the fucking.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've done some good work here today. We've covered a lot of ground.
I feel like that's true. And you know what? The research department has provided some colors of the day.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Look at them.
Right?
They're kind of oceanic and crabby colors.
They are. Yeah. Should we?
Well, let's dive in. Oh, that's an ocean joke.
Oh, careful for those of you who are sitting in the splash zone.
Yeah, look out. So the first of the two colors that we've been graced with today is titled interstitial nearsightedness, which is probably something that I have when I think about it. I'm very interstitial and I am nearsighted. Weirdly enough, in one eye, super bad, and in the other eye, not so bad, which gives me depth perception problems, which is actually worse than being nearsighted in and of itself.
Right. Yeah. No, you know. We're only going to do the job halfway, so you're just left like with just this fucking hurdle to go through life. Good job.
Yeah. Yeah. It's excellent.
Yeah.
It's great when we move through the world.
So
interstitial nearsightedness. Oh, yeah. Were you going to do the RGB? Go for it.
Yeah, I was going to say. So this is a this color has the red, green, blue values of 64, 130, 237. So a little bit of red, little bit of green, well, half the green roughly and full blue, yeah, basically.
Yeah.
And it's a so you can I'm going to give you the hexadecimal value, and you can, if you're listening, you can chuck that in the Googler and it will show you this color right on the Google screen. So what you do is you type in octothorpe or hashtag. So hashtag 4082 echo delta. So that's 4082ED. You just put a hash sign right in front of it or a pound sign. And that will show you this blue. I'm not sure. I'm trying to think like what it's like a. I'm trying to think what this is kind of close to.
It's a little too purple. It's not purple, but it has like a hint of red in it, which brings it closer to purple than not. And it's like sky blue, but it's not blue enough to be sky blue. There's too much contamination from the red and the green.
It's almost like a royal blue, maybe like a regal blue. It's
not periwinkle, because it's not quite purple enough to be periwinkle. It's like a dusty kind of bluey. Like it would be I would totally expect to see this color in a bridesmaid dress or a tie.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So the complementary or the secondary color is the tangible inhospitality.
Yes.
Tangible inhospitality, which is I was just thinking about like the way we split the podcast up, where it was like the first part was about indecision or interstitial nearsightedness, and the second part was about a very tangible inhospitality. Like
yes, it's so perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is go ahead.
Yeah, this one like is kind of like a really dark mustard color. Like it reminds me of like the rocks in like Utah or those like national parks where there's like there used to be a massive river running flow that carved the rocks into weird shapes, and now all the water's gone, all that's left is the weird shaped rocks.
Yeah.
Like that kind of an orangey browny color.
Yeah. And so the RGB values are 191, 125, and 18. So you got a lot of red at 191. You've got a fair amount of green at 125 and very little blue at 18. The hexadecimal value, which you can put in Google, is hashtag Bravo Fox 7 Delta 12. So that's again, it's hashtag BF7D12. That's a Bravo Foxtrot 7 Delta 12. Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. So put them in there. Put them in the Google if you want, or, you know, look them up however you like. I don't want to tell you how to live. And, you know, use these colors. They're the colors of the day. So just keep in mind.
Perfect for today.
Perfect for today. Yeah. You're listening to this podcast. Now is the day. Now is the time. Use these colors in your art. Now is the time. Find a way to express yourself. If you're feeling especially tangible in hospitality, this is the color for you. Or if you've got some, you want to convey the idea of interstitial nearsightedness, we've also got a color for you. So, yeah, that's it. Also, this email us, tell us what you think, or email Dana. So Dana is the founder and CEO of this podcast, and Dana would love to hear from you. And you can complain to Dana about why we didn't cover the topic the way that you wished that we did. And you can send Dana an email. And the way you do that is you write your email to dana@fcbm.io, or you can go to fcbm.io and check out our pretty basic website where you can listen to the podcast for free, not get tracked by Google. And generally, well, I can't prevent you from being tracked by Google depending on how you access the website, but we don't have any particular trackers ourselves. And we also have, I think, some other email addresses, which is really just how we're doing contact at this point. We used to have some social media, but you know, this is it now. So
yeah,
right?
That's it.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you made it all the way to the very end of the podcast. Good job.
Great job. You deserve a parasite. Just kidding. You deserve dinner.
You deserve dinner. Yes.
Don't eat parasites.
Don't eat parasites. Yeah. I mean, unless
I feel like that is a decision. See, sometimes knowing what you want is less important than knowing what you don't want. And if you establish that you do not want to eat a parasite for dinner, you're already on your way.
See, I think that this decision tree, like there's different ways of doing it. Like maybe the decision is like, am I feeling moody? What is the purpose of the food? Is the food to eat? Is the food conventional? Like, is it like because of convention, social convention, it's time, it's dinner time? Mm-hmm. Is it dinner time? Is it time because you're hungry? Is it time because of the wall clock? Is it time because other people are hungry in the house, but you have to make a decision for them? Like, you know, this decision tree is, I almost would argue we need to build like an expert system, which were early forms of a kind of, I don't want to say artificial intelligence in the way that people think of it now, but an expert system is basically like a huge database of knowledge, and you can kind of query it in a sort of search capacity. You're like, you know, why am I eating food today? I'm hungry, you know, or whatever.
Yeah. What is the reason?
Yeah.
What's the context? What's we need the context.
Yeah, exactly. But I can imagine, I can imagine the decision tree being pretty interesting. I mean, it's also like deeply limited by like what you actually have available to cook, right?
Oh yeah.
So you know, is the decision tree to adapt to what is available, or is the decision tree decided like set up in a way that drives what you make sure you have available? I don't know. It's a lot going on there. Maybe that'll be a whole other podcast.
Yeah, I think we need to come up with like a whole deck of decision trees for as they pertain to food. Like from like very utilitarian, like, are you hungry? Yes. Okay. Here's some things that you could eat.
Yeah.
Right. To like really fucking weird and abstract shit, which I feel like is where we shine.
Yes.
The more absurd, the better. Yeah. Like, yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, either way, we've got our work cut out for us, and we just finished a great deal of good work. We are killing it.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the great things about living in a hotly contested reality is that probably there's only a handful of wrong answers compared to the totality of all of the possibilities.
Right? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
Well, now I suppose we should go do some other work.
Okay. Well, that's our podcast. Kind of a long one. Thanks for listening.
Yay.
Okay. Bye.
Great job, everybody. Okay. Thank you for listening. Bye.